Your rebates, discounts, and gas bonuses are unaffected. With your Fred Meyer reward card, you can turn cheese puffs or office supplies or cat litter into support for KABU. Go to fredmeyer.com/community rewards, all one word, and link your card to KABU.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Before My Time Has Come music video premiere on Saturday, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. at 5th Avenue Cinema in Portland. The song Before My Time Has Come was written 3 days after Parkland
and is dedicated to school shooting victims and survivors. This event features a live performance of the song, the video, showing guest speakers, and more.
Again, that's the Before My Time Has Come music video premiere on Saturday, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. at 5th Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland.
More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Wednesday Talk Radio is up next.
In a summer season when soft was the sun, but that was then, now the summer locks the land in an iron embrace, and the sun hits hard, hard as a hammer, and the sour seas surge, and the rivers run dry, and an acrid stench leaks from the sky, and it feels like we're at war with nature. So on this bare-boned hill we gather, a throng of thousands following the rumour that on this day and in this place God will come, God the Redeemer. And many are preaching the end is nigh, for the earth upheaves and hope runs dry, and fear is rife, fear for the future. And as we watch and wait and wonder, on the hill's brow a tiny figure creeps into view, and now we see a woman wizened in rags like a beggar. Is she sent from God? We look for a sign, searching her face for a spark divine. And over our heads the helicopters hover. She stands so still in silent sorrow, brown like the earth, old as the weather. The choking air, the fevered sun, and the woman weeps like a grieving mother. Then a helicopter swoops like a bird of prey, scoops her up, carries her away, and we feel like hope is lost forever. Who now remembers the sound of birdsong? I have seen oceans lashing out in anger, forest fires that scorch the sky, waves of children fleeing hunger. We were forewarned, but we took no heed. Too late now to punish the ones whose greed has plundered our children's children's future. In a summer season when soft was the sun.
And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. That was the great English singer-songwriter Leon Rosselson from Where Are the Barricades? And 4 degrees Celsius. And we've got someone on the line from London, England, United Kingdom, to talk about 4 degrees Celsius. Well, I don't know. Are we headed that way? That's the question. I guess these people aren't watching, waiting, and wondering. They are acting. They are part of Extinction Rebellion. Good morning, George Barda.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're quite welcome. The sound is a little scratchy. I'm not sure what the problem is and if we're going to be able to remedy it.
I'm not sure. This is probably about as clear as it gets at my end. Is that any better?
Well, not it's not great, but we will persevere, and if it gets too much, we will have to I'll have to go solo, but let's see how it goes. So you are part of Extinction Rebellion, which has been engaged in large-scale protests that have blocked bridges and attempted to obstruct Parliament and generally mess things up for business and life as usual in the UK. And so talk about what is Extinction Rebellion and how how your trajectory got involved with it and where you think it might be going.
So I guess, the difference between Extinction Rebellion and what's been happening recently in terms of sort of climate and environmental activism in the UK is that it's neither sort of protest or direct action, that that's generally been understood in recent times. Protest being the 10 to thousands or hundreds of thousands of people in many cases coming along every now and again to demand change for climate change and then going home. And then direct action, which is specifically about kind of targeting destructive infrastructure at source and trying to, stop, delay, disrupt, etc. And all of which is absolutely vital, as you've seen in North America, with the pipelines actions and, stopping the ports, I gather, in places like Oregon, the direct action to try and stop the fracking industry getting off the ground in the UK has been utterly crucial to kind of holding that dam back. But I guess the difference here is that this is specifically about re-embracing civil disobedience as a tactic to try to inspire thousands of people effectively to consider putting their own bodies and potentially freedom on the line to target directly government, that is the linchpin of all this corruption. This isn't about a movement saying it's not about fossil fuel companies, it's about the government. It's precisely about the powerful vested interest in fossil fuels and elsewhere being the driving force of actual government policy, and I think that's something that is understood as an increasingly kind of common sense. But so I guess what this movement is focusing on directly is the need for, an absolute transformation in terms of the sort of legislative agenda, the framework of economic incentives and rules and all the rest of it that essentially make it legal and profitable still virtually everywhere in the world to destroy life itself at exponential speed.
So George, hold on a second. I'd like to get someone maybe to call our engineer and tell him if this the sound quality is actually listenable. You are on a landline, aren't you?
I'm on a mobile, but it's usually fine for these kind of things. I can take my headphone out, but
See how that works.
Hello.
That's better.
Is that any better?
That's somewhat better.
Is that better? Yeah, I can do it this way if that helps. I mean, the line was a little bit fuzzy when it came on, so I don't know whether it's worth trying again or something.
Perhaps it's a little crackly, but maybe we could get a listener to call in at 503-231-8187 and tell my board op Heather if they think this can go on. It's as unfortunate, but it was hard to kind of get a test in advance because you don't know how it's going to be. So Extinction Rebellion is a bold name. I kind of came of age as an activist with Earth First, which felt like a very bold name. And we tried to kind of live up to it with a lot of bold actions, which, in the time in the 80s, 90s, it really actually had kind of an outsized impact to the actual numbers involved. What kind of reaction are you getting from folks about the actual name Extinction Rebellion and how'd y'all come up with that?
I think there's a group called Rising Up that emerged out of a thing called Compassionate Revolution, and Extinction Rebellion emerged as a sort of specific project, if you like, of Rising Up. And I think it's really kind of caught on, not least because there is really, I think, just in the last couple of years, a sense that we are not only facing the extinction of thousands of other species that put together account for the possibility of our own survival, but that also, human peaceable survival in anything like the, you know, at anything like the current scale is radically under threat now from problems that are not just projected to be in the future, but that we see happening right now with devastating consequences across the world. And I think that's the difference between now and maybe 10 years ago. I mean, it's not like there weren't massive increases in extreme weather events by 10 years ago, but I think the common sense has kind of caught up with that. Not least just because there's been such a sort of cascade of disasters, from wildfires, planning typhoons, to droughts and floods, to related military conflicts and civil conflicts. I think that we are in an emergency already, and we have very, very little time to prevent what is already a disastrous situation for hundreds of millions becoming catastrophic for everybody. I think that's something that is much more broadly understood than before. And in the face of the recent IPCC report into the vast differences between the destruction at 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, and the fact that I think anyone that looks seriously at the science of this stuff realizes that even 2 degrees now is a very, very outside chance, would require absolute transformation, I think makes that's kind of sharpened hearts and minds and bodies, if you like, in recent times. And, you know, even for 4 degrees, this is a terrifying thing. I mean, 4 degrees would be catastrophic for the world beyond imagining, and, you know, almost certainly would mean feedbacks that would go beyond that. But, you know, for 4 degrees, we're already talking about 3.5% global carbon emissions cuts from the early 2020s. You know, so even 4 degrees, we are kind of in danger of blowing past. And that's when you take out of the kind of IPCC and therefore sort of mainstream political discussion the very buried but hugely significant factor of negative emissions and geoengineering. So to put that more simply, what governments are saying to their people in terms of these kind of pathways to doing their bit on climate change, so to speak, pretty much all of those now have massive chunks for hundreds of billions of CO2 that we're somehow magically going to take out of the atmosphere later in the century. And I think the people who do get that and who get how little the story of our actual emergency has been effectively conveyed to the majority of people, a movement that is directly about trying to expose that, specifically in terms of government's catastrophic failure to protect their people's future, I think that's something that's really... That it's touched the zeitgeist. It certainly helped us also that within days of, 2 days before, I think, the Extinction Rebellion launched officially in Parliament Square in the UK, there was a big report from WWF involving lots of scientists into the sheer scale and urgency of the extinction crisis that we face. And the headline conclusion there was that this is a threat to human civilization on the level of climate change. In other words, people in this movement recognize it's not just about decarbonizing the energy system as soon as we possibly can. It is about a transformation of the way the world does business and relates to the land that it uses to produce food, et cetera, et cetera.
Indeed, indeed. Well, the massive wildfires in California, as you say, the typhoons and hurricanes are certainly getting people's attention, and exactly, you know, what to do about it. It seems it's been clear for a long time. It seems in some ways simple, but in some ways utterly complex, because, you know, we involve incredibly complex economic and political systems, economic systems that we're also intimately involved in, and technological systems that we're also intimately involved in. And it seems daunting, the idea that we actually may have to dramatically scale back our uses of large numbers of devices and such. But, you know, so it's of course the not just a, you know, more and more people also are realizing it's, you know, there are no real individual solutions. And you say you're targeting government, but it, you know, there, of course, the governments have been, you know, if you look at this new report, the greenhouse gas emissions gap wider than ever, that just came out, that says that global greenhouse emissions in 2030 could be between 13 billion and 15 billion tons more than the level needed to keep global warming within 2 degrees Celsius this century, and the fact that, you know, none of the countries that have signed on even to the voluntary Paris agreements have actually lived up to their pledges to reduce.
And
go on.
Yeah, no, and then I was just going to add that, as many of your listeners might know, you know, even if they do follow through on all that, all those pledges, that probably takes us to 3.5 degrees of warming, which is unimaginably catastrophic. And so I think the, you know, going back to the key task of this movement initially is really just to expose the truth of what is going on, you know, what is implied by even 5 more years of business as usual, let alone, you know, 15 or 20 or 25. And I think the other thing that's kind of shifted is a kind of more concrete sense of the failure of, albeit kind of well-intentioned attempts on behalf of the sort of mainstream environmental movement to try and bring about change. You know, this focus on sort of individual action and this kind of naive assumption that that would sort of organically mushroom into sort of system-level change because people felt empowered from the individual level to you know, to push for the changes required. I think it was an approach that basically was fairly blind to the very, you know, massive power relations that are involved in this. You know, the fossil fuel industry is not just one of the richest industries in the world of all time, but it's by virtue of its like centrality to the economic system, is the most politically entrenched industry of all time. I mean, you might say perhaps finance even more so, but obviously finance holds most of these assets, etc. So I think it's the combination of the urgency, the kind of visibility of the government failure in relation to this 1.5cc report, and the failure of resistance in a business as usual manner, trying to resist business as usual, that has failed, and that it's kind of irrational to pursue the same failing path going forward given the urgency. I think all of those things have kind of come together in this moment, which has accounted for why there's been such interest from across the world in what this movement is trying to do.
Uh-huh. And I'm speaking with George Barda, who is a spokesperson on behalf of Extinction Rebellion. He works with an environmental non-governmental organization, is a father and has a master's in environmental politics and globalizations. And he's been involved with Rising Up, which is a platform to enable people power to enable people power the pursuit of social environmental justice, and which I understand rose from I'm passingly familiar. I went to actually an Earth First gathering in the early 2000s, and sort of learned, got a crash course in UK environmental history. But it's of course been a long time since then. But I know that there's been a lot of different strands of activism in the UK that sort of fed into this Rising Up and also into Extinction Rebellion. Maybe we could go a little bit briefly into that history and maybe a little bit your own personal history, but I want to give out the number. Apparently we're good. We've had 5 callers say that they're okay with the sound quality, so I guess we'll go with that. Maybe it's just my headphones. Okay. Anyway, it's 503-231-8187. That's the studio line, and that's to join in this conversation again with George Barda with this I find exciting. I don't know, I like the messaging, you know, Extinction Rebellion, at least it seems to be kind of up to the, at least rhetorically, up to the dire situation that we find ourselves in. I just find myself constantly a sort of a disconnect between even the level that we're actually thinking and talking about what's going on and the pace at which climate change continually exceeds not only our ability to react to it, but even our understanding of it. So thank you for that. So yeah, talk a little bit about what kind of what fed into the diverse strands that are involved in this this sort of new phase of the climate movement in the UK, Extinction Rebellion.
I think you've touched on something important there, that we've had 25 years of climate science that has been explicitly deeply conservative in its conclusions and methodologies, and you've had, you know, billions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry, et cetera, trying to frame that science as alarmist. And one of the other big differences now is that we can see, we have real world data to compare against the projections, and what you see on a kind of constant drip feed in the media is more and more stories coming out saying, you know, it's worse than we thought, it's worse than scientists thought, it's worse than scientists thought. And so I think that has contributed to a kind of much more general sense of the fact that the way this problem has been managed and framed and the story told as something basically manageable in, you know, decades future, that has all essentially kind of broken down. And I think that the one of the kind of core aspects behind Extinction Rebellion is that there's a lot of kind of academic study out there now in terms of understanding how you can try and create the maximum impact with the smallest number of people. And one of the main guys involved in the early stages of Extinction Rebellion is an academic at King's College London, part of the University of London, effectively, who's an organic farmer whose organic farm went bust because of climate change, effectively, but is also an activist of many decades, but now very much an academic expert in escalation strategy. And I think the fact that expertise went into such a kind of impactful first couple of weeks of the movement, I think, has given a lot of people confidence that there is something to the way that the thinking behind this has been going on. And I think that probably accounts for why a lot of people who were involved in things like, there was a movement called Climate Camp in the UK from 2005 onwards, that was focusing, it was basically, the main focus was big annual events in the summers focused on kind of particularly destructive symptoms of this problem. So the first one was at a place called Drax coal-fired power station, which is one of the biggest coal stations in the UK. It's now burning vast amounts of American forests, by the way. I think I'm right in saying from roughly your part of the world, we're literally, you know, transporting millions and millions of tons of trees basically to burn in what were coal burning chimneys.
Wait a second. So explain this now. I know this is something that I should have been covering more, and it's been on my radar. But we're talking now about shipping four trees across the ocean to actually burn in X coal plants to produce energy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely, one of the sort of many unbelievably kind of immoral compromises over the last 10-20 years of climate politics is the role of biofuels. And so you have this crazy situation where the EU rules, supposedly European Union rules, supposedly to kind of move us towards a sustainable future, have incentivized vast amounts of deforestation in Indonesia to create palm oil to burn instead of petrol, which is actually worse for the climate, let alone that vital ecology than actually using fossil fuels. And so one of the other sort of evil siblings of this kind of biofuel madness is this burning of forests instead of fossil fuels, as if that's a sustainable solution. And so the argument goes that, oh, well, this is from sustainable forest management in the US. If that is the case, and there are very big ifs there, but even if it were the case, of course, what's happening if you're using the wood, you know, to make energy, you're not using it for other things that it could be used for, which is displacing deforestation to elsewhere. But I mean, the madness of what's going on here is most sort of extreme in the sense that because of how the rules work in the UK, and because one of these five giant chimneys in this, you know, giant power station has been converted to biofuels, it actually allows the power station to burn more coal than it would have done otherwise. Because there are some pollutants that are slightly lower in biofuel than in coal, so that actually means that they can burn more coal. These kind of false solutions, and that's a phrase that climate activists, I think, are very well aware of, these false solutions, whether it's, you know, carbon trading, i.e. kind of rich countries writing some story about how they're protecting a forest somewhere else to carry on standing to justify, you know, right now, today, you know, these things are unfortunately the sort of mainstream so-called climate response is shot through with these kind kind of scams, basically, that are giving the impression that the problem is being dealt with, but in many cases actually making it worse. And I think I'm right in saying that they're trying to build, or they're planning at least to build, a whole new kind of deep water port in the UK, precisely to kind of be able to receive more forests on giant tankers from the US. There are so many angles at which you look at this thing. Even the parts of the problem that are have been framed as solutions to the problem, and you realize that they are in fact amplifications of the problem.
Rather than admitting that this mad profit-oriented economic system that we're all trapped in is actually fatally flawed. In fact, flawed from the very beginning. It just created illusions that it actually benefited masses, number of people, and could get ourselves. But wait a second, let me just, we've put the number out and hold your thought there. Let me just invite Sean, our first caller, to join the conversation, and then you can pick up with your comment. He's been waiting a while. Go ahead, Sean.
Okay. Good morning, Paul. Hey, thank you for everything you just said. Amen to that. So the reason I called this morning, it seemed like one of the diabolically genius aspects of the whole Reagan-Thatcher agenda was to convince a significant number of people that their interests were coterminous with the interests of the capitalist elites, and I'm thinking specifically of something like 401k plans instead of normal retirement plans. So a lot of middle-aged and elderly people that own their own homes, they're utterly dependent on the rate of return they're getting in their 401k for their retirement plans. And so they might have fossil fuel companies, they might have defense industry companies. I was wondering if your guest could comment on that whole Reagan-Thatcher agenda of convincing people it's individual lifestyle choice versus systemic, and that the whole 401k, the whole retirement idea was just another way of tricking people into thinking, personal lifestyle choice can make a difference as opposed to systemic change, and we'd probably all be better off if people just divest themselves of all their interests with the capitalist class. Thanks.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think there are sort of two separate issues there. I think one, you're absolutely right. Like, in the UK, is like a kind of test bed for how that works. Like, one of the statistics that's really telling in terms of the point you're making is, I think when Thatcher came to power in 1979. The ratio of people in unions versus owning their own homes was 3-1 in favor of being in unions. And then by 94 or something, a couple of years after she'd left, that ratio had reversed. So three times as many people owned their homes as were in unions. And that's just one of many indicators that kind of backs up the point that you're making, that I think basically the neoliberal system is all about rendering a significant subset of people totally dependent on this system, basically kind of keeping going. So if they want a decent pension when they're older, that can only happen if the stock market is still rising, and of course that only happens as long as the stock market can keep kind of extracting value from people and planet and the future and all these things. But so people do have their futures kind of tied into those expectations. Similarly with house prices have gone up hundreds of percent because they've commodified housing, and I think especially in the UK because there's quite limited land space and planning regulations, etc. When of course economies collapse, the value of houses can drop as a whole overnight, as you guys know from the financial crisis. And so I think that's a big factor in terms of this kind of an extra incentive for denial of admitting how unbelievably destructive this system is to any chance of a decent future for our children. But I think the other point that I'm not sure I quite understand the direct link with, but that of trying to get people to think in terms of their personal behavior being the appropriate way to try and influence the world, I think was a very sort of clever deception. So I think in the 90s they called economic democracy, you don't need to be a citizen anymore, voting doesn't matter so much, it's all about how you spend your money. And of course the fundamental problem, there's so many problems with that vision of democracy, but one is that obviously the more dollars you have, the more votes you have in that system. And so I think the focus on individual behavior has been a massive diversion in many ways from the change that needs to happen. It's also true to say, though, that the kind of pockets of kind of ecological consumers, if you like, have been part of starting these different alternative supply chains that have that constitute the alternatives that are kind of sitting on the outside of the giant Death Star system that we have at the moment. And so if we can meet this political moment as we need to, then those, you know, the product of those individual positive individual consumer decisions can be turned into something positive. But at the moment, it remains largely a kind of expensive and neurotic distraction from the failure to address the systematic problem.
Okay, George, hold on a second. Let me just say that this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, and I have on the line, a little bit scratchy, but apparently understandable to our listeners, is George Barda, and he's a part of Extinction Rebellion, which is, as I called it, a new phase of the climate movement, seemingly more in your face. Of course, there's been quite a lot of direct action, civil disobedience around the world, here in Portland, around the United States, that certainly have seen. I'm not claiming that necessarily this is necessarily new or different, but it seems to be more a large scale in the urban areas anyway, trying to get masses, numbers of people to actually disrupt by blocking bridges, by blocking Parliament, other areas. And maybe we can tell more about what some of the targets and what some of the strategies are in order to just sort of bring the crisis much more front and center in people's daily awareness. Anyway, I just want to read the demands, and Mike and Kathy, just hold on another second. I just want to read these demands. This is Extinction Rebellion, Fight for Life. We are facing an unprecedented global emergency. The government has failed to protect us to survive. It's going to take everything we've got. Three demands: the government must tell the truth about the climate and wider ecological emergency, reverse inconsistent policies, and work alongside the media to communicate with citizens. The government must enact legally binding policy measures to reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025 and to reduce consumption levels. A national citizens assembly to oversee the changes as part of creating a democracy fit for purpose. And I know there's already been at least one pushback in The Guardian. The climate crisis demands more than blocking roads. Extinction Rebellion, maybe you can address that. But let's go to our next caller, Mike. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I really appreciate your show and all the points made, particularly the underlying thing of capitalism being so important here. But I'm really concerned when I hear talks about climate change, which are coming so much more rapidly. It seems like animals are censored out of the discussion by environmentalists. And this, to me, is wholly a product of lack of compassion for animals, not fossil fuels, not transportation. Transportation is a symptom and a byproduct of what's going on. But if we don't learn how to have compassion, we might as well give up the planet. We might as well, you know, we won't learn anything about fossil fuels either. We've got to learn compassion for animals and the way we're churning them out in our industrial system. Of course it's going to kill a planet, and it's never mentioned by environmentalists.
Well, that's not entirely true.
Why it's not mentioned? It is true. I haven't heard you mention it once. And it's consistent. When I say never, I mean relatively compared to fossil fuels. I just don't understand it. I don't understand. To me, this is a problem of lack of compassion for animals, because we can't live on a planet, we can't have a sustainable planet, when the biodiversity is being churned away by the way we process animals. It hurts our soil, it hurts our air, it hurts our water to a much greater extent than transportation.
George, you want to tackle that?
standard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the kind of one of the ironies of the movement that we're trying to launch at the moment is that, I guess, because we framed it as being about climate change on the one hand and our kind of unimaginably destructive and uncompassionate relationship to the world on the other, because there's actually so much kind of complexity and there's been so much confusion and intentional deception, etc., around climate change at every level, you know, including the kind of, you know, the suppressed negative emissions and all that in the IPCC report. You know, there's so much complexity there that it's easy to get stuck on that and not to kind of bring appropriate focus to our relationship to the rest of the living world and the spectacularly central aspect that our destruction of particular chosen animals to eat has on the rest of the planet, and absolutely that's very much part of this movement. I think where this movement kind of coincides with kind of previous efforts in principle, but it's trying to do things a different way, is that it's much easier to talk to people about transport changing in principle to less destructive forms than to tackle the way people, because it's such a kind of fundamental identity culture issue. And so I think for that reason, a lot of NGOs have been, and you know, and even kind of, you know, direct activist movements made up largely of vegans have kind of sidestepped that issue. And I think just for basic compassionate, but also for ecological reasons, that can go on no longer. I mean, what I would say also, though, is it's not just about our relationship to animals that we eat. It's about an entire attitude to the world as essentially something, you know, for us to make money from, that is, you know, treated as if it's infinite, even in the light of, you know, these incredibly worrying reports about how much we have already destroyed its functional capacity. And some of the, you know, like listeners in their, you know, even 30s and 40s will have recognized that the day on which the world overshoots the ecological capacity of the planet to replenish, the day in the year that happens formally has gone back about, you know, to 2 or 3 months just in the last, you know, 10-15 years. In other words, we're overusing the planet faster and faster, and absolutely animal agriculture is a central feature of that problem. But it's not just animal agriculture, that's a huge amplifier of the problem, but it's the, you know, the kind of toxic mentality to food production generally, where we think we can just kind of lay poisons on most of the surface of the earth, you know, that are basically biocidal, and somehow imagine that things are going to kind of carry on all right, where basically you know you're wiping out insects, or you're wiping out birds, you're wiping out habitats, you're wiping out the whole thing.
Yeah, fundamentally, it's industrial agriculture to begin with. And of course, you know, Oregon and Portland, we tend to live in a bit of a bubble. Obviously, we're probably still a minority of people who eat a majority of organic produce and are either vegetarian or vegan or minimally meat eaters like myself, so we might tend to congratulate ourselves and maybe not fight as hard on that. I mean, I've been against industrial agriculture and, you know, the meat industry my whole life, my whole adult life. I've been either a vegetarian or, as I say, a minimal meat eater, which some people might take issue with. I mean, I actually challenged some vegans on you know, well, okay, so how do we make this, you know, because I think that my personal belief is that the Extinction Rebellion sort of model is a mass rebellion sort of model that can go in numbers of directions. I even, you know, we've had the people who are the valve turners who shut off the flow of tar sand oil from the pipelines on KBOO. I've had them on my show, which I think are admirable actions. What I'd like to see is, you know, we had the fight against the Keystone XL, the fight against the Dakota Access, but we never got to the point where we were able to actually have people power physically occupy and shut down pipelines and cut off and maybe dismantle a pipeline. And that's the kind of thing that actually really gets interesting to me. You know, we have to build to that. And, you know, so I would like to see, you know, I would like to challenge people to maybe focus on the, you know, we're not there, but in Southern California, there's some massive feedlots. I'm sure there's some in Oregon. Maybe I should be talking about that. But these massive feedlots, you know, cattle feedlots, I'd like to see, you know, hundreds or thousands of people actually, you know, shut it down, occupy it and shut it down. Yeah, I'm disgusted by these industrial animal agriculture. I'm disgusted by how we treat animals. I try to, you know, live my life in a way that minimizes that. And I should probably talk about it more on the radio. But anyway, here we're talking about it now. It's a complex systemic crisis. We need massive uprisings in order to have even a chance of challenging it. And I think Extinction Rebellion is doing that. And hopefully it grows in many different directions, you know, as more people get involved. Okay, let's go to Kathy, who's been patiently waiting. You go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Great show. I wanted to point out a different point of view about the idea that individual actions, such as individual purchasing actions, are inadequate to the situation compared to governmental action. Right now, really, we could do tremendous things with individual actions if we got enough people on board with them.
Well, that's the key then. How do you get
enough? That is the
enough,
key, absolutely,
right.
Yes. And shows like yours are and KBOO in general, are one of, you know, so far rare in radio people getting the word out into you know, an audience that could be much broader, of course. But the thing is, we can spread, and we need to recognize that we can spread and put effort into the effort of spreading. But the reason why individual actions need to be encouraged is that governmental actions will follow individual actions, as they did in the 60s. The idea that individuals can't do anything, it really runs counter to the idea that the grassroots is extremely powerful. Voting with your pocketbooks and eating vegan or less meat, you know, if you know, this could happen tomorrow. Like if we got the word out, you know, broadly enough, tomorrow enough people just cut down their meat and dairy. Incidentally, dairy is almost as bad, if not worse, as meat. So all you vegetarians, wake up. If we just dial that down, you know, like one meal a day with meat and dairy instead of three, just tomorrow. I mean, it would immediately have an impact, and then that goes with agriculture.
Yeah, big if. I agree with you, and I do it myself, and I encourage other people to do it. But the problem is we're facing a situation where the feedbacks are happening so fast, so absolutely terrifyingly rapidly, and they're still beyond even our ability to actually comprehend them, let alone react in terms of, at whatever level, at governmental, corporate, individual, that there's really. Really not. We don't have a point where we're actually gaining leverage on the situation, and we don't seem to have. So what people are doing, Extinction Rebellion is doing, is, you know, they're anyway. I'll let George tackle that. But thank you, Kathy, for calling up and expressing that. I support you. I support other. I don't think there's any contradiction between righteous and conscious individual action, encouraging other people to. You know, to change their behavior and actions, and concerted large-scale mass actions. There's no contradiction whatsoever there. They don't work against each other. In fact, they need to work hand in hand. So thank you for that. George, you want to respond?
I'd love to respond to Kathy. I think she's brought up really, really important points. But I guess where I would frame it slightly differently is that what she's talking about is if individual actions could become collectivized at scale in terms of the demand side, then we could have, you know, a significant impact on this. You know, and as you pointed out, that you know, that alone isn't going to deal with it. But the question is, how do you go from having a kind of small percentage of people that have a demonstrable but small effect on the system, given that we have to totally transform it tomorrow, how do you go from that to a situation where our individual actions are like concerted, coordinated, and therefore effective at system level? And the analogy I often use here is like in the Second World War in the UK, like we had, there wasn't enough food, basically. So at some point, the government turned around and they said, right, you know, there's not enough food anymore. We're going to have rationing from now on. So that meant that everybody had a sense that their individual behavior was part of a coordinated collective effort that would have the desired collective result. And that was, I think, vastly, vastly more effective than if the government had turned around and said, as of tomorrow, everybody try and consume less. I think that the big sort of elephant in the room here is that the neoliberal system has basically done a very kind of canny, deceptive and kind of evil job of framing the individual level to some extent as an alternative for the collective citizen level. Margaret Thatcher very, very famously said there's no such thing as society, there's just individuals and families. And I think that was a really kind of canny way, in the context of increasing, you know, social and personal insecurity, of kind of shifting people's human nature to the more sort of ideal one, where we're acting based on mutual aid, and in a context where we can trust that our actions are synchronized with other people's positive actions on the one hand, and the kind of the more defensive setting of human nature, which is, you know, in the face of insecurity, you kind of batten down for me and mine. So like, it becomes natural when you can't trust the wider context to focus on, you know, you and your family. And so I think the key thing is to kind of overturn that incredibly disempowering turn in politics, because, you know, for 150 years it was totally imperfect and there's a long way to go, but there was fairly major progress in terms of, you know, women's rights, civil rights, workers' rights, you know, weekends in most of Europe, at least, you know, access to healthcare and services and all sorts of things. And that happened because people realized that we are many, they are few really works when a critical mass of people take their sort of individual power and join it together with others in turning those many individual concerns into coordinated pressure and leverage that targets the dominant institutions. So the, you know, the last thing I'm saying is that people should feel sort of disempowered about the impact they have on an individual consumer level. But in a world of literally, I think, about $2 trillion is spent every year, $2,000 billion around the world on public relations, marketing, advertising, etc., i.e. manipulating the context of people's decisions. In that context, it's very difficult to imagine how that individual behavior, as opposed to, you know, a level of civil disobedience that would take control of the reins of power back from the corporations and the big agriculture companies, etc., it's very difficult to understand how that would bring about the speed and scale of change required. So for me, this is not about, you know, disempowering the individual level, but about linking it together with the kind of coordinated collective actions that are required to turn those activities undertaken by maybe a few tens of millions, maybe a few hundreds of millions across the world.
Okay, Giorgio,
turn those into the status quo, which is what's required. In other words, we have to replace the past system with a new one.
We got a couple. It's a vast track, and a lot of people just sort of either give up or take a ironic stance or a stance of despairing. I waver between various modalities myself. I'm sure you do too. I'm sure the people involved in Extinction Rebellion. But, you know, what it comes down to is we're up against it. And that's why I like Extinction Rebellion Fight for Life. It just puts it right out there. And it just doesn't beat around the bush, basically. So let's see. We got 10 minutes left, which is not much time. We have George Barda on the line from the United Kingdom. What a terrible name. I can't believe you all still have a monarchy there. But hey, I guess that's another fight. So
that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, maybe the, you know, the royal family, you know, sometimes they actually, you know, they some of them take actually, you know, good positions on some of them are naturalists and all in favor of the environment. Won't name any names, and sort of try to give the royal family a good name despite the vast amounts of investments they have in no doubt terrible things. Anyway, so George Barta is on the line. There's a new old movement, a new phase of an old movement, whatever you want to call it, Extinction Rebellion. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you've been doing and maybe where things are beginning going, but let's hear quickly from George. Go ahead, you're on the air, George.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for the program on this extremely grave situation.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to get the correct spelling of your guest's name, and I would like, if your guest has written a paper or more or book, I would like to hear about that. But I don't want to take any more time. This is ultra urgent. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye.
George Barta, Barda, right?
I haven't written a book, I'm afraid. I'm less proactive than I might have been. I have considered writing a book called Compassionate Revolution, which is the name of technically the sort of parent organization of Extinction Rebellion, and it's perhaps worth mentioning that in the light of what your previous caller said about the centrality of compassion to the shift that has to happen. And one of the really interesting things about this current historical moment as well is that there's so much coming together in terms of our understanding of like neurophysiology and individual human health and public health and all these things. And to cut a long story short, the kind of changes that we're talking about that we have to bring about to have any chance of a world that isn't collapsing for our children would actually be hugely beneficial for the vast majority of people and would create much happier, healthier societies where, you know, our children in cities like London wouldn't have to be born from day one. And in fact, from the uterus onwards, having their brains stunted by air pollution and all sorts of other things. So that there is, I think, there are many aspects to why we could look back on this moment as the kind of key turning point, not least because of all the work that's been done already in so many areas, targeting so many of the problems.
So before we go to Mac and Edie, our last two callers, I want to get you. So you know, you people have been blocking bridges and protesting in front of Parliament. So one elder woman was arrested for gluing. For locking herself or gluing herself or something to the doors of the Parliament. Just talk a little bit about some of the actions that have happened and where you think this movement is going, and if it's spreading beyond, or how it's connected to other parts of the climate movement around the world. Talk a little bit about that.
So the basic approach basically is to create maximum social and economic and informational disruption. So the way that we've gone about that so far is through a combination of very targeted actions using often quite a few small teams of affinity groups of direct activists or civil disobedience, however we phrase it, targeting places like the government department responsible for energy decisions. We've had actions at the other part of the government responsible for, you know, the environment and food and farming. But I think what's made those smaller actions significant is these much bigger actions that try and draw together as many people as possible into actions that basically sort of target iconic infrastructure. Because I think one of the problems we've had in the last 10 years is that, well, there's been a lot of really worthwhile action against fracking and all sorts of things like that that have definitely changed the national conversation. The level of the actions taken find it very difficult to get any kind of any real penetration into the kind of mainstream news agenda. And, you know, the background elephant in the room here is that I think the environment is still treated by so many people as this kind of thing on the outside for trees, polar bears, and environmentalists. And you know, in my communications, I tend to like avoid the word environment as much as possible for that reason. So the key focus here is to sort of mainstream awareness of the scale of the problem and focus on it, but also to really focus
on government as the linchpin of all the corruption. And this is, I guess, an important point to emphasize, because we're targeting mainly government infrastructure so far. This is not about like letting off the fossil fuel companies or dismissing the relevance of direct action targeting them, but it is about having a very clear-sighted vision of the fact that as long as the laws and the economic incentives of a country make it, you know, legal and profitable for the destruction of life as we know it, then it will go on far too much as before, with, you know, with some slightly better aspects on the edge, if you like, which is sort of where we are at the moment. More renewable energy, more, you know, like small scale examples of wonderful different ways we can do things, but basically not a single country on the planet has turned around and, as far as I know, introduced either a kind of emergency decarbonisation plan as to how they're going to leave fossil fuels in the ground and not use them, and neither have they announced a kind of land reform transformation that would revolutionise our relationship to the living earth on which we depend for our every breath, you know, and mouthful of food and you know, every drop of water. And I think this is, you know, this is really important to emphasise. What we are threatening is an extinction on the level of the other mass extinctions that have hit this planet. And I think it was the Permian extinction that when all life basically collapsed in the ocean, the consequence of that was a sort of anoxic poisoning to the planet, literally like poisonous gas flowing out of the sea to the point where the creatures alive on the planet couldn't breathe and stay alive because it was so poisonous. And that is really what we're up against. And so this movement is about trying to get as many people inspired to be in this for the long haul on the basis that it's the right thing to do, not because there's some like instrumental analysis that can kind of give us a definite end point as to, you know, how and why and where we're going to be successful. It's just about recognizing that unless we bring about this kind of radical disruption that becomes visible to the mainstream, not just every now and again, and not just to people who consider themselves environmentalists, that this is really about trying to have the most universal possible frame at the front of what we're doing, which is we all want to give a safe, secure world to our children, but we're also, of course, using the platform as much as possible to allow voices that represent the largely non-white communities across the world for whom this is already a catastrophe. And going back to your earlier caller quickly, you know, talking about individual level action and the significance of it, because 10% of global carbon emissions, 50% of global carbon emissions come from the top 10% of people, and the bottom 80%, I think, in the world are responsible for only 20% of the emissions. There is a huge amount that can be done in the short to medium term if we can bring about a change in the rules that stop the tiny percentage at the top massively overusing the capacity of this planet. And I think, as I said before, I think the sheer scale of the crisis and the fact that what our governments have signed up to, like in theory, commits them to the necessary action, puts us in a very different moment right now than we've been in ever before.
So essentially, the government, you know, we have to somehow miraculously turn the governments who are basically in the service of the oligarchy against the oligarchy, because, you know, there's been a lot of interesting studies saying that it's actually oligarchy that has ruined just about every civilization. It's that's the problem is the inequality itself, mm-hmm. because you have these classes, the people, you know, as some book once said, the rich are different. They become different because they basically become immune to the problems that they actually themselves create and the suffering that is created amongst the other people. And that is on a almost a cosmic scale at this point, as the basic life on Earth, or anyway, so-called higher life forms are being threatened by, as you say, this toxic environment. That's my say. Probably said too much. I probably should have asked you that last question at the beginning. I'm really glad you got a chance to give your full statement about what Extinction Rebellion is all about from your point of view. I think you've probably expressed that well. We're about out of time, George. I'll be following your movement and have you or someone else back on. Please keep us informed. both me personally, and you guys can always call in to KBOO or send us a message. I'll give you that information so our news team can continue to follow what y'all are doing. Best of luck. It's we're all in this together. Go ahead.
If I could just jump in with one more really practical thing, because I know I can get sort of lost in this sort of important theory. But what we're pushing for is a global mobilization in the spring, so probably April next year. And this movement is run in under what's called holacracy, which is basically a way of organizing things that allows people to take action as independently as possible from any sort of central deciding body. So basically the message to all your listeners is that anything you can do to link up what you're currently doing with what we're doing to, you know, so we can get a real global strength in numbers, or anyone that isn't sort of very actively involved that wants to, you know, start an Extinction Rebellion group locally or join the Extinction Rebellion group, all of that is really vital.
Okay, and we've got links to that through the magic of the internet at kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you, George Barta. We got to get out of here. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Paul Rowland, thanks for listening. Thank you, George.
Thank you very much.
In a summer season when soft was the sun, but that was then, now the summer locks the land in an iron embrace, and the sun hits hard, hard as a hammer, and the sour seas surge, and the rivers run dry, and an acrid stench leaks from the sky, and it feels like we're at war with nature. So on this bare-boned hill we gather, a throng of thousands following the rumour that on this day and in this place God will come, God the Redeemer. And many are preaching the end is nigh, for the earth upheaves and hope runs dry, and fear is rife, fear for the future. And as we watch and wait and wonder on the hill's brow.
Ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com/community rewards. Every time you use your card, KBOO will get money. Your rebates, discounts, and gas bonuses are unaffected. With your Fred Meyer reward card, you can turn cheese puffs or office supplies or cat litter into support for KBOO. Go to fredmeyer.com.